For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, death row inmate Richard Glossop gets an 11th-hour stay from the Court of Criminal Appeals. Glossop faces a September 30th execution now for a murder he allegedly hired someone else to do. The actual murderer is serving life without parole. Neva, is public opinion about this case changing as more people learn details about it?
I don't know that it's changing. I mean, clearly, this is a case where I think that the consensus is that it was a prudent way for the court to proceed. And I think I would agree still with Attorney General Scott Pruitt when he said that after the Court of Criminal Appeals gets time to review this latest information, that he feels confident that the conclusion will be the same and that the execution 2 weeks from now will go forward. So I think the bigger picture on this is that it has become a case where literally Glossop has become kind of the national poster child, as has been described, for those proponents against the death penalty and trying to make this a case not only for Oklahoma, but to take this debate nationwide.
Ryan.
You know, I think that more and more people in Oklahoma and around the nation and around the world, you know, largely the debate's been settled. But right here in America, as more people realize that the administration and the application of the the death penalty in the capital punishment system is just wildly broken, I do think that it's beginning to turn the tide on how people think about this. I mean, right here in Oklahoma, we have a real deep and oftentimes healthy distrust of our government. And this is government exercising its power at its greatest. Yet to be able to strap somebody on a gurney, stick a needle in their arm and kill them is the ultimate thing that a government can do. And so the idea that the state of Oklahoma was literally hours away from executing a person who is not guilty of a capital offense, while the person who actually committed the murder is sitting in prison. And this isn't some anomaly. There are cases right now where prosecutors in the state of Oklahoma are seeking the death penalty against people who didn't pull the trigger, weren't the actual people that made the murder happen, and the actual murderer isn't receiving the death penalty. So there's randomness in how it's applied, and then we've also seen that we're really unable as a state to administer it in a reliable manner that protects against cruel and unusual punishment.
I think, though, when you talk about public sentiment, I mean, there's nothing to indicate, even national polling still indicates that there's an overwhelming agreement that there is a need and a reason to have death penalty on the books and as a as something that a jury can in fact say is proper given the case and the facts as they hear them. And let's remember, in this instance, 18 years have passed. We've had two trials that he has gone through, and in both instances, the jury came back and said that that in fact he was guilty and that the death penalty was a proper action to be taken. So, you know, I think again, it's easy to try to extract these cases out and confuse the facts, but when the court looks at it, when the Court of Criminal Appeals looks at this new information, these revelations that now the attorneys say have come to light, I think what we'll find is when the dust settles, this will move forward as it should.
Which then brings up the question, it's been 18 years. If Glossop had been accused, had been convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, like the guy who actually committed the murder, we would have heard about it. He would have gone away and it would have never been heard about. So, but it's this appeal after appeal after appeal and millions of dollars spent by the state of Oklahoma. Is it getting to be costly effective?
That's totally not cost effective at all. And we get to this point where I know that it's been 18 years and we can say that there have been two trials, but at the end of the day, Glossop has only had adequate legal representation that does this kind of work, you know, that does this capital defense work, this late post-conviction relief work, for a matter of months at this point. I mean, we're not talking that these people have been working for 18 years. And in that matter of months and really in the last couple of weeks, what have they been able to put together? They've been able to put together a mountain of evidence to submit to the court. And in fact, they're going to be filing supplemental briefs to submit even more new evidence to the court. Even more troubling is that some of the evidence seems to have been destroyed before the appellate process was all the way over. So, you know, all of these, and that's, you know, that's why I think that this case is so interesting, and you don't have to become a member of the abolition movement to say that the death penalty is not wisely applied in the case of Glossop, because it's not a matter of whether he's innocent or guilty. He may very well be guilty of something, I don't know, But I can tell you confidently that he's not guilty of a capital offense, and that's what people in Oklahoma and around the country and the world are seeing. That's why we've had so much outrage over this case. And I think that it really underscores that this is the kind of system that we've got, the kind of capital punishment system where a guy like Richard Glossop could be on death row in the first place.
An Oklahoma district judge orders state officials to remove the Ten Commandments monument. Despite last-minute maneuvers by Attorney General Scott Pruitt, they have 30 days from last Friday. Ryan, how's that going?
I think that we're at a point now where the last-ditch efforts by the Attorney General's office were laughable. They were frivolous. They were thrown out by the court. The process now is moving forward. You know, I think that within the next 30 days, we're going to see the monument removed. It's going to be taken to a lawful and appropriate location. And this is a real victory for people of all faiths and no faith at all in Oklahoma. This isn't something about our plaintiffs didn't invent this idea of protecting the sanctity of the state, the seat of state government for all Oklahomans, regardless of their faith. And this is something that goes back to the founding days of our republic. And so what we've seen vindicated here are ideas that are as old and even predate our republic and are incredibly important to the way of life that we have in Oklahoma.
Neva.
On this one, I think Ryan and I absolutely are diametrically opposed. I think what we have here is a case where the findings, there is a legitimate argument for the historical purposes of the Ten Commandment monuments. And I think the Attorney General, in their writings and what he's articulated publicly, I think, frankly, not only a majority of Oklahomans, but I think a majority of Americans can understand and accept the arguments. First of all, that the Ten Commandments are not only an important component of the foundation of the laws and the legal system of the United States, but also of our state. And secondly, I think that the courts and various state and even in city arguments, they have found that they have cited the Ten Commandments as a reason in published decisions, as well as the fact that I think it would not be debatable that the Ten Commandments have played a significant role in our nation's heritage throughout our history. So I think the hostility toward this Judeo-Christian heritage, which is part of the formation not only of the Constitution but our entire legal system, really calls into question, this debate that is ongoing. And I think there are legitimate reasons. Certainly there was an effort to try to have additional time for these arguments to be laid out even further, and that was not the case with the ruling last Friday. But I think this is a fight, as I said last week. It's certainly not over, because I think what we will see is the rising up of lawmakers and just public sentiment in Oklahoma that will say, if it takes changing the Constitution to allow us to move forward to one day bring back the Ten Commandments monument, then that's the direction that I think we will see in the next election, and we'll have it on a ballot in November of 2016 in all likelihood.
I think it's interesting that the Attorney General's office was arguing for more time to argue the Ten Commandments monument, really to argue arguments that they could have argued at the very beginning of this case, and in fact, they kind of did. And then in the Glossop case, you have the Attorney General and the governor saying, well, he's out of time. Let's execute this person in this irrevocable process. To me, those things just really don't match up well. And the difference is that Glossop has only recently had the expert capital defenders on his team. The Ten Commandments monument has been defended by the state's top lawyers and been defended by the top religious.
But the time argument is bogus. I mean, you can't. It's whichever side of the coin you want to argue. I mean, with Glossop, let's give more time. Let's make sure that the Court of Criminal Appeals has an opportunity to hear this new evidence. But then, Attorney General Pruitt, we're not going to give you any more time because you're the top, legal beagle in the state, and you should have already known and made these arguments. So time out for you.
Yeah.
So I think it's just which side of the debate we all fall on this. But clearly, there's a lot more room for discussion on this, and it's not an argument that's going to go away by any stretch of the imagination on either side. I think.
The idea that I say that the ideas behind the removal of the Ten Commandments monument are as old or older than the republic. The idea that we're somehow integrally attached to the Ten Commandments monument as our way of law. Now, I think that it's important to remember back again to our founding and to think of the words of George Washington whenever he was explaining that it wasn't a matter of tolerance in our nation, because tolerance wasn't enough. Tolerance presupposed that there was some superiority of one religion over another, and really, tolerance wasn't enough. It was true equality, and we can't have equality when we've got a monument that reflects the faith of one or two particular religions telling people how to believe, because those are individual decisions, not
government
decisions.
George Washington and many of the founding fathers were also ones that in their documents, including many of our founding documents, talked about divine providence being part of what brought this country into existence and what sustained it and what helped develop the ideals that we still use as the foundation for not only our legal system in this country, but certainly our government philosophy and way that we approach just doing business from a government standpoint in all 50 states.
We need to move on. Three people are putting themselves up for consideration to replace
Congress. Now you're telling us no more time.
I know. No more time. That's it. Let's move on. Three people are putting themselves up for consideration to replace controversial Republican state chairman Randy Brogdon, who quit the position after just 5 months on the job. Candidates include current Vice Chair Estella Hernandez, UConn businessman Robert Hubbard, and State Federation of Republican Women President Pam Pollard. Neva, your thoughts on these candidates?
Well, we have three candidates, just like we had three candidates when Randy Brogdon was elected. And it's a little bit kind of the same mix. I mean, I think what we have acting, it's actually Estella Hernandez is the acting chair of the Oklahoma Republican Party now, having moved up from vice chair with the resignation of Randy Brogdon. As you mentioned, Federation of Republican Women in Oklahoma, their president, Pam Pollard, and then Robert Hubbard, interesting guy. I mean, he is the person in the race that appears to be where most of the Brogdon supporters and sympathizers have trended toward early support for. He's a guy that ran against Frank Lucas in 2014, ran against Mary Fallon in the Republican primary in 2010. Certainly someone that, again, I think we've got this divide among the party activists that will go to the meeting on October the 11th to make this decision. And I think it'll be where we see finally the activists come down. Do they want to kind of reestablish a foothold, put someone in as head of the party that can help raise money, can help recruit candidates, can help kind of moderate the position to the extent that we're not in national headlines, with craziness almost every month? Or do we continue to have this kind of fringe element of the Republican Party really just wanting to kind of throw hand grenades and make outrageous statements, but not really wanting to do anything that effectively is something that the majority of card-carrying Republicans, I think, would support and want to see? So, I think this meeting on October 11th, it'll be a Sunday afternoon here in Oklahoma City. It all gets down, as we say, in elections, who comes out to the polls. It'll ultimately, in this instance, be who comes out to vote on that day.
Ryan, do you think the GOP has learned its lesson from the last 6 months of Randy Brogdon, months of Randy Brogdon?
Well, I don't know. The national headlines once a month, that sounds like an improvement. I mean, I don't, that'd be better than where we're at right now. One of the last things that Brogdon did in his tenure was this outrageous Facebook post where he compared people that were receiving state services to animals. Mm-hmm. And that received attention across the nation and was one of those national headline things that I think doesn't reflect well upon the state GOP or the state in its entirety. One of the candidates here in this race, Pam Pollard, she's got some experience with that herself. I think in one instance, she's been instrumental in removing an embarrassing Facebook post from a group that she manages or that she's an administrator of on Facebook. But she's also said some pretty outlandish things on Facebook herself, saying things like we need to, get rid of public schools. We need to send boys to work with their dads and let the little girls follow the moms around the kitchen, that we could eliminate textbooks and just teach from the Bible. I mean, I think that, these are the kind of things that if that's the voice of the state party, it's going to be difficult for them to really be competitive in 21st century politics. And that's unfortunate for all of us.
Lawmakers come up with a suggestion to fix the teacher shortage problem in Oklahoma. A bill which could be taken up in the spring, increases pay for retired teachers from $15,000 a year to $18,000. Ryan, your thoughts on this new plan?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. But at the end of the day, if that's what we're relying upon to fix the teacher shortage that we're working on, it's just a drop in the bucket. We've got administrators that have canceled hundreds of classes across the state this year. We've got approximately 600 teachers in classrooms today under emergency certifications, 1,000 teacher shortage, increasing class sizes. There's really no way to gimmick your way out of this problem. I mean, you've got to really fix the revenue model. Unless you've got an across-the-board pay raise there to attract and retain teachers, then it's just not, we're not going to make a dent in the real problem that's out there.
$3,000 a year seems like a lot, but that's only for retired teachers. Why not do this across the board, Nima?
Well, I think that'll be the debate. I mean, it won't be isolated to just retired teachers. I think what they were talking about in this instance is they have the 1,000 teacher shortage coming into this school year. So they're trying to figure out a way, how can we get qualified people into the classroom quickly? And the suggestion is that we get some of these retired teachers to come back, we incentivize them, and that we allow them to continue to take their retirement and also have this additional pay in the formula. But Ryan's right. I mean, it's all about the dollars, and we can't really deal with this piecemeal. And I think that's where it becomes very difficult. Everyone is looking for kind of these Band-Aid solutions on, you know, the shortage in the classroom, the salary versus the regional and national average. I mean, all of these components. But, you know, when you start putting the pencil to it, just like in the last two sessions, I mean, Senator Sharp had similar legislation that basically didn't even get out of committee. And what happened was when the actuary put the pencil to it, I mean, it was the fiscal impact was so significant that that they didn't even hear it in committee. So I think that's where we're at. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to find something that really can have any life in the legislative process because the dollars simply aren't there. Yeah. So what else are we going to do?
And it's too little too late as well, because this won't be taken up till spring. It's got to get through a debate. It's got to go through the House, the Senate, be signed by the governor.
Yeah, the school year's behind us.
It'll be next year before this takes place.
If this even happens. I mean, like I said, you know, this is a good idea. It's drop in the bucket, but even if we could do it, it's a good idea. But even this Band-Aid, you know, we don't have a price tag on it yet.
That's right.
But it's not going to be free. And so we're walking into a session where I think people on both sides of the aisle are looking at somewhere $1 billion shortfall, give or take. So we got $1 billion shortfall. A lot of the one-time cash reserves that we've been using aren't there.
And again, we've got one of the most vocal groups that come to the Capitol. I mean, the education lobby, however you want to slice and dice that, whether it's the School Board Association, whether it's the Teachers Association, whether it's the classroom teachers coming up there themselves, whether it's concerned parents, whatever the mix, those are some of the most forceful, vocal folks that the lawmakers have to deal with every session, and it makes it a place where they want to try to do something because they know they're going back home and having an election that they're going to have to face just 2 months after, or really a month after they leave session next year if they have a primary. So there'll be a lot of pressure to try to say, okay, where can we find some money and let's shift it here and say that we're making progress on trying to raise teacher salary, trying to do more for education in general in Oklahoma. But I'm not sure the public's going to buy that because it's the same argument that we continue to hear session after session, and then we look at the facts and figures and they just don't match up.
Right. Are the education who's the most vocal going to be more vocal than the conservatives who say cut spending?
Well, and the conservatives in that argument, they've got the deck stacked in their favor, because with $1 billion shortfall, it's a lot easier to cut spending than it is to say that we're going to come up with new revenue or shift money from other services that are already struggling in the state. And then on top of that, it's an election year. So it's, you know, even Band-Aids like this, I don't think have much of a chance in this legislative environment that we're walking
into. Well, let's face it, raising revenue, who wants to go back home and say, hey, I'm the guy that helped raise your taxes? I mean, look at me, because this is going to really, you don't like it now, but you're going to love it later. That's going to be a tough argument. I don't think very many people are going to hop on that train.
But as we go down this road, at some point, the debate's going to be less about, I think that legislators are going to have to come reckon with the idea that it's not about saying, I raised your taxes. It's going to be, you get what you pay for. And these state services that we all enjoy, that we all benefit from, they cost money. And at some point, there's a price tag to it, and either we pay it or we don't.
Or we right-size government and we do some things that are difficult, because that means state employees and other folks may lose their jobs, that agencies may either be consolidated or eliminated, things that can be done that have government implications but have less impact on the folks out there just paying the bills, trying to raise their family, pay the taxes. I mean, those are the folks that have to be kept in this equation. And just like at the federal level, it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard when you start talking billions of dollars to remember who's paying the freight on this.
But when state employees the taxpayer. Get laid off, you raise your unemployment. It makes it look bad. The economy goes down.
But they have to go back. They go back into the private sector where they have similar jobs. Oftentimes, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in corrections, whether it's in education, wherever it happens to be, there are private sector jobs out there that many of these people that have become that are in the state system right now could move back into the private system. I mean, is it painless? No, but I think we have to be much more realistic about what long term will give us a fix rather than just this idea that raising more taxes is somehow going to be the magic formula that's going to help us get past all of these ills.
Studies pointing to 20,000 fewer jobs over the next year, that we're in a real recession in Oklahoma or at the beginning of one. And so the private sector market for these folks to transition into is not as welcoming as it was maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago.
There you go. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.